One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
All right, so Matt, I figured something out the other day, and I thought this was pretty cool, and I wanted to share it with you. Did you know that here in the United States, all cities are named after their water tower?
After their water tower?
Yeah. I mean, if you go through, you got, you know, says Dallas on the water tower. So obviously they build the city around them and they call it Dallas.
You worked hard on that, didn't you?
I did. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the graveyard. Thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Adam.
And my name's Matt.
Now, pull up a tombstone or settle into your casket and get comfortable, because this is Graveyard Tales. All right, everybody, here we are again. Matt, how you doing tonight, brother?
Whew, I'm good. It's a rare night in the graveyard.
So it is.
We're not usually up on this night,
but nope.
It's going to be fun.
Right. Yeah, we a couple days later than normal, but it did mess up our routine, but you know, a little... spontaneous stuff is nice every now and then.
Yeah, we're not telling y'all.
Yeah, exactly.
What night this is?
No. If we told you, then you know that would spoil the secret. So,
whatever it is, it was weeks ago.
Yeah, exactly. Whenever you're listening to this, just know this was a couple weeks ago when we did this. So. So real quick, we wanted to thank Podbelly, podbelly.com. We're proud members of the Podbelly Network, so go check them out for other podcasts and to find out information on how to record a podcast, for software to what mics to use and all that. Check them out, podbelly.com. We also wanted to, if you are not a Patreon member, then go sign up for Patreon. We're trying to put out videos for the $10 plus patrons, and we're, you know, getting audio stuff out for the other patrons, and we're trying to keep it active. Now, when this month is a little weird, because Matt's going on vacation, I'm going on vacation, and you know, we had a little family issue on my side, so it's kind of keeping us from getting as many Patreon episodes out as we normally would, but just hang with us and we'll make up for it by getting more out. But on that note, another thing that helps us, if you can't donate monetarily to become a patron, then reviews help quite a bit. Go to, you know, Apple Podcasts or whatever and rate and review us on there. Give us 5 stars. If you want to give us anything below 4 stars, just don't worry about it. You know, like Mama said, if you ain't got nothing nice to say, don't say anything at all.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can write whatever you want in there. Just click the 5 stars. It helps us out tremendously. It helps us grow in the charts. And we've got to beat these famous people who started their podcast because they're bored. Matt and I do this. Yeah. At, you know, this is our gig. We've been doing this for 3 years now, just about. And, you know, they're movie stars. They don't need this. So give us a review instead of Dax Shepard or whatever.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, Adam, I found something. I heard a story today.
Now, right.
I don't know how huge of a story this was, because where I heard it was, you know, fun news. And I think the story broke back in June, so you may have heard this, but it was too good not to share.
All right.
So just a little quickie before we get into the main meat of the show. But so this story, Adam, you may have heard it. If you had, you hadn't mentioned it. But it's a former soccer player named Guillermo Marino. Now, he was late to a training session years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this is just now coming out. He arrived late because he said he was abducted by aliens.
Okay? No kidding.
Yeah. So Guillermo Marino shows up late to a training session, and his excuse is that he was abducted by aliens. Says,
I need to use that excuse more.
I mean, you know, he said, I left and I came back 2 days later because I was kidnapped by aliens. And they said, but, you know, he's not that kind of player. He was a really proper guy. And everybody knows Marino. And he started to explain that he was suddenly lost and abducted by aliens. He explained that they take out your soul, analyze it, and all the while on the journey, they're looking after you. Something like that, he said. And it was, you know, his two teammates on, it looks like the Universidad de Chile team from 2011 to 2013, say that this situation took place back then. And Lord Zeddy is the player that was in the interview. He's confident that Marino is telling the truth, and he didn't believe that Marino was the type of player that would just make up an excuse like that because he was running late.
That's wild.
And when I hear this story, I'm like, that's great. You know,
oh, yeah.
You show up and everybody's like, where the hell you been, man?
Yeah.
I was abducted by aliens.
Yeah. So on the way over here, you're never going to believe this. You're never going to believe this. What happened was this spaceship came down. What? I mean, I think this is the first time, Matt, that I have heard an abductee claim that they remove your soul to examine it.
Yeah.
You know,
that's a new one.
You may get stuff like, well, you know, they can look at your life and da 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 da, but never have I heard the phrase they remove your soul and examine it and take care of your body.
And take care of you the whole time.
Yeah.
I loved it.
I mean, like,
this is great.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I love that story.
Because what else are you going to do?
Yeah.
You know, you show up and there's like, I got abducted by aliens, man.
Yeah.
Really? You can't come up with anything better than that? No, man. Yeah. I swear, I'm telling the truth. You know, this is what happened.
Yeah.
And you're just kind of like, well, you know, you're either just call him out and go, okay, you're done.
Right.
Get out. Or you're like, well, man, you know, he's really good. We got to keep him around.
Yeah. You're so flabbergasted at that point. You just allow it to run. You're like, okay, whatever. Right. Just keep going.
But in all seriousness, it does kind of go back to what you and I have talked about before. People that come forward and have a story like this that have something to lose by sharing a story like this.
Yep, exactly.
You kind of want to believe them. You know, I mean, you know, they've got a reputation. You know, I mean, you don't want to be labeled some kind of crackpot. And
right.
You know that's bound to happen.
Yeah, unfortunately, I mean, people still label you as that nowadays if you come out with a story. We're still not to the point where some, you know, people, the mainstream believes you, you know.
Yeah.
So the mainstream is going to say, oh, this dude's a wacko, you know. And so you are risking a lot by coming out and saying something like that. So
yeah,
that's interesting. I had not seen that one, and I like the details of his story.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm Tom.
And I'm Andrea.
And we're the hosts of We Drink and We Know Things,
the podcast. We're a husband and wife comedy show.
We cover all kinds of stuff from UFOs to cryptids.
We also cover a lot of true crime and some paranormal.
And we do it all while getting drunk.
Yeah, we sit in our office, we have a good time, and we have some drinks.
Every month we put out bonus episodes.
We give you some cool stuff like creepypastas and the glitch in the matrix.
So be sure to come and hang out with us.
We're a weekly podcast.
Doused in alcohol.
And lit with knowledge.
Clinkies!
So, Matt, since we're so good at segues and our non sequiturs are amazing, that note, tell us, what are we talking about tonight, brother?
Well, tonight we are talking about more disappearances and more weird occurrences and more things where people could go, listen, you are not going to believe this.
Yeah, right.
And we've got some stories like that tonight. We're going to talk about the Lake Michigan Triangle.
And yeah.
I know a lot of you are out there going, what?
Yep.
What is the Lake Michigan Triangle?
And I even know some of y'all in Michigan may not know.
That's right. And you may think, I know about the Bermuda Triangle. I've heard about that. I've read about that. I've never heard of a Lake Michigan Triangle. Well, according to a lot of people, it really exists. And a lot of the same things that have been attributed to the Bermuda Triangle occur in the Lake Michigan Triangle.
Exactly.
So Adam's going to give us a little bit of history and kind of go into where it is and what makes it up. And that'll kind of give you an idea of the area, the geography that we're talking about. Then we're going to dig into some of these stories because some of them are pretty weird. And,
yeah,
you know, they don't really have easy explanations.
No, which is, I mean, that's classic for a triangle of sorts, you know,
that's
either
right.
Lake Michigan or Bermuda Triangle. I mean, you look at some disappearances in the Bermuda Triangle. There is no easy explanation for that. And like Matt said, that parallels the Lake Michigan Triangle, I mean, a lot. So
yeah.
Let's get into it. First of all, if you want to keep going on the research, go down and check out our sources at the bottom of the show notes. You can see what we've covered and maybe go on to some other stories and facts that we did not get to cover because we didn't have time to. But now Lake Michigan is the third largest of the Great Lakes. When you're measuring like water surface, it's the third largest. And only... And it's the only Great Lake that's located entirely in the United States. The rest of them are partially in Canada. Its name is derived from the Ojibwe Indian word Michigami, which means large lake. So Michigan, Michigami, large lake, makes sense. Now, Lake Michigan's water surface is 22,300 square miles, or for our metric listeners, that's 57,800 square kilometers. So that's a big lake.
It's a big lake.
Big lake.
I'm not gonna do what's going on in my head.
Yeah, good.
I have a joke. I'm not gonna do it.
Save that for Patreon. Well, it's the second largest of the Great Lakes by volume, and it's 1,180 cubic miles or 4,920 cubic kilometers, and only Lake Superior is bigger by volume. Well,
I'll tell you this, Adam. I can remember the first time I actually saw Lake Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
I was in my early 20s, and I mean, I had not been anywhere. I mean, I'd been to the ocean.
Right.
You know, and I'd been around the South, but I hadn't really traveled much further north than Kentucky. So early 20s, I'm like 21, 22. I'm in Chicago and I see Lake Michigan for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was amazed because in my head, I knew what a lake looked like. I mean, this was like, it was like looking at the sea.
Yeah, it's an inland ocean is what it is.
Huge, you know. I'm looking out there and there's like enormous boats. Yep. I mean, sailboat, not lake boats, ocean boats.
Yep. And waves.
I mean, there's a beach. I mean, yeah, there's waves. And I had no idea. So, you know, if you've never visited the Great Lakes, you know, it sometimes it's hard to wrap your head around how big we're really talking about when we keep using the word lake. You know, lake is the technical term.
Right.
You know, because officially, you know, the way they are a lake. They are just enormous.
Ginormous, yeah. And, you know, it's hard to get scale when you're looking at a picture. It's hard to really, you know, if you Google search pictures of it, you can kind of tell, okay, those boats seem a little big for a lake, you know. And for some of our overseas listeners, you know, they may never have the chance to see it except in photos and stuff. And it's just, it's hard for me, who's lived in the United States my whole life, to wrap my head around how big Lake Michigan is, you know. So someone who doesn't live here probably can't wrap their head around it either, even with these stats on, you know, surface area and everything, you know, 22,300 square miles of water surface. That's hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah, it is.
But Lake Michigan being so big, it touches Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin. So approximately 12 million people live along the shores of Lake Michigan, according to the New World Encyclopedia. Now, some of the major port cities that I'm sure you guys have heard of include Chicago, Illinois, with a population of 2.7 million, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 600,000, Green Bay, Wisconsin, of 104,000, and Gary, Indiana, of 80,000. So, you know, Chicago is obviously the biggest, but you've got a lot of other large port cities that touch Lake Michigan. Now, on the northern end, Lake Michigan and Lake Huron are connected by the Straits of Mackinac, and this is a 4 to 5 mile wide channel. So, basically, Lake Huron and Lake Michigan are the same lake. They're the same body of water, technically, but because that it's just like a 4 or 5 mile wide strait, they chop them up into two different lakes, Lake Michigan and Lake Huron. So when you're looking at it, just, you know, keep in mind that both these bodies of water are the same body of water.
Mm-hmm.
Now, water temperature on Lake Michigan, you know, may get into the 60s in July and August. And it can sometimes make it to the 70s when the air temperatures have been in the 90s for a number of continuous days. So it's not a cold lake, but it's also, you wouldn't want to jump in to 60 degree water for long.
Right.
You know, that will chill you to the bone pretty quickly. But
unless you're my kids.
Yeah, right. Right.
Pool's open. I look at the thermometer. Hey, it's 60 degrees. There, splash.
Yeah.
Are you insane? Get in, Dad. No.
Yeah. Nope. Nope. Yeah, I know. I think you and I talked about it. Michael, for some reason, does not know cold water. You know, it doesn't bother him. And for me,
he's a polar bear.
Excruciating if it's too cold.
Yeah. Uh-uh. Oh, Amanda, she'll cut you to get out of it.
So, continuing the water discussion, to get off the cold water and kids thing, the water of Lake Michigan has this weird, like, circulatory pattern. They say that it resembles the traffic flow in a cul-de-sac. So, like, going down one side, making a loop, and coming back the other side. So, it's this weird, like, circular pattern that most lakes, they say, don't really have. it also moves really, really slowly. So despite the circulation, you probably couldn't tell, you know, by average observation because it moves so slowly.
Yeah, you're not going to put a paper boat out there and watch it just start spinning around.
Right, right. It's a really slow lumbering circle. Well, they say winds and resulting waves keep Lake Michigan from actually freezing over during the winter, but it has been 90% frozen on a number of occasions. They say ocean-like swells, especially during the winter, can result in a drastic temperature change along the coast. Also, shoreline erosion and difficult navigation. So the wind and the waves on this lake make it difficult to traverse the lake.
Yeah.
And, you know, that will come back up a little bit later, but just keep that in mind. They say the average water depth of Lake Michigan is 279 feet or 85 meters, and its maximum depth is 925 feet or 282 meters. So that is a deep lake.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's crazy how deep that lake is. We got to look at kind of how it was formed to understand why it's so deep and why it's such an unusual lake. And the formation that's recognized as Lake Michigan today, they say, began around 1.2 billion years ago when two tectonic plates were ripped apart and created this mid-continent rift. And y'all may have heard the mid-continent rift before, but...
One continent got mad at the other. They both brought potato salad to the family picnic, and it started this rift.
And it started this rift, and it's been going ever since. It's a 1.2 billion-year-old potato salad rift.
Look, you know, I said I was bringing the potato salad.
Yeah, but yours isn't good enough, so I brought mine.
You were supposed to do baked beans.
No, your potato salad isn't good enough. I brought mine because I didn't want to disappoint the people.
There's too much onion in your potato salad.
Hey, there's just enough onion in mine. There's not enough in yours. So,
there's your dramatic reenactment of the tectonic rift. Yeah,
mid-continent rift there. As you can tell, Matt and I are from the South, and we have heard this discussion between family members before. That's how we could properly portray both sides.
Every year, every family reunion, every 4th of July picnic, every graduation.
Thanksgiving, you know. Well, they say about 14,000 years ago, the glacier that occupied Lake Michigan, and the Lake Michigan Lobe, as it was called, began to pull back from a large highland area that flanked the southern part of this lake basin. Now, the last pullback from this highland area created a lake between the retreating ice and the moraines. And if you don't know what moraines are basically linear deposits of rock and debris that was left by a glacier that was still for a while so that it could build up to a high level. So at the end of it, you know, the ice is always moving in a glacier, and it's always picking stuff up and dropping stuff. And the moraines are at the end of this glacier, where it keeps dropping sediment, dirt, rock, you know, trees and stuff, and it's creating a long straight deposit to basically create a wall, is what the moraine is.
So, I thought it was just the way Michigan people called a stupid person a moron.
Yeah.
You moraine.
He's kidding. We love you, Michigan people.
We love you.
And essentially, though, the moraines acted as a dam at the southern tip of Lake Michigan so that water could pond behind it, between it and the glacier that was pulling back. Now, waves that lapped up against the moraines formed the first Lake Michigan shoreline in what is now called the Glenwood phase of the ancestral Lake Michigan. It was 8 miles landward above where the modern shoreline is. So it was 8 miles further in than what we now have. This shoreline area is called the Glenwood Beach area. Now, in parts of this quote-unquote fossil beach, there is only a little wave-washed pebbles and some dune sand left. But in other areas, the Glenwood Beach is a large, you know, multi-fingered sand pit capped by dunes, and it's real dramatic and all that stuff. But, you know, it varies between those two. Now, continued retreat of the Lake Michigan ice lobe from this basin opened outlets across Canada that rapidly lowered the elevation of the lake. So it was high, right? And then as the ice pulled back, it allowed the water to escape back and go into Canada and other parts of the Michigan area. So the lake level dropped. Now, the first time this happened was about 12,200 years ago. Now, this time of low lake level is known as the Two Creeks phase. Now, it ended about 11,800 years ago when the ice re-advanced into the basin. So, have another resurgence of the ice coming into the basin. And every time this happens, the reason I put all this in there is every time the ice comes in and goes back and comes in and goes back, think of it as a warm spoon in your ice cream tub. So every time you go through, it's gouging out sediment, which is making this lake deeper and deeper and deeper every time it moves. So the readvancement of this closed those Canadian outlets that it had, so the water ponded again and got real high. So the lake level is up and down, and it's gouging out and making, you know, a deeper and deeper lake because this ice moved so much. Well, then about 10,000 years ago, the lake level rapidly fell again. This time, the low lake level is known as the Chippewa phase of the ancestral Lake Michigan. The elevation of the lake may have been more than 100 feet lower than today. So by that time, it has scooped out a lot, but there's not a lot of, you know, there's about 100 feet less water in there than there is now. Well, the lake then continued to rise after this, and we end up with the lake that we now see today. So there's your geography and history lesson of the lake.
Ta-da!
And like I said, the reason I put that in there is just so you would understand by this advance and moving back of the ice, that just think of it as scooping out. And that's why we have such a deep lake. And I guess some of y'all will find that interesting. Some of y'all will be fast forwarding through that to this part right here.
Shut up.
Yeah.
Shut up.
So for those of you that made it through that, thank you. For the people that skipped forward, here is your cue to start listening again right now. Now, French explorer Samuel de Champlain sent his underling Jean Nicolet to find the, quote, Northwest Passage.
His underling.
His underling. Yep. That's
I need
a nice,
an underling.
That's the nice way of saying your go-getter and, you know, hey, I need you to pick that up, guy. Hey, I need you to go get that guy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay.
I was an underling at my last job for a long time.
Yeah. I'm going to start introducing the young kids as underling.
Oh, yeah. That would be good. That's how I'm going to introduce Michael. This is my underling. He acts out a lot, though. I ask for the TV remote, and he doesn't go get it. I don't know. Well, he sent Jean Nicolet out to find the Northwest Passage, but he ended up discovering Lake Michigan instead around 1634. In 1679, Nicolet explored the southernmost part of the lake where modern-day Chicago is now. So let's talk about what happens on the lake nowadays. We talked about waves making shipping difficult. That's because there is a lot of shipping that happens on this lake. I mean, most of the ships you see out there are transporting goods. You know, it's a high traffic lake, and there are major shipping lines that run basically everywhere on Lake Michigan. And they ship everything, iron ore, coal, limestone, farm products, steel, and what they call project cargo, which is an industrial mining equipment and, you know, big things like that, when they determine that road transport would be too disruptive. So here in Texas, you know, they would just shut down lanes to bring this industrial stuff through, or airplane parts or whatever. Well, up there, they would say, hey, if we can get it over there through Lake Michigan, let's do it. And mm-hmm. so they send it on these big old ships across Lake Michigan. Now, here's a really cool thing that we discovered that we need to talk about that might explain some of the things that Matt's going to talk about. There are two ley lines that run directly across Lake Michigan. So we need to talk about what ley lines are. And we've mentioned them in other episodes, but we've not actually really discussed them, I would say. Right, Matt? We haven't really gone
right.
into
Yeah, we've never really dug deep into ley lines, but we've talked about them a lot.
Right. So the theory is that big, important monuments, you know, like Stonehenge, pyramids of Giza, and all that, are running on a kind of energy highway, quote unquote, that kind of connects them all. So ley lines are kind of like latitude and longitude lines in one sense, but you know, they're not actually lines that we can actually see on a map.
Right. I'm looking at a map right now of them. So,
right. And I saved a few, so it's not a normal map, but I do have a map of ley lines. Yeah. Now, some claim that ley lines carry a powerful magnetic field, while other people say that they hold some psychic power.
Yeah.
So everybody kind of agrees that there's something up with these ley lines. But still other people, they claim that the lines are somehow associated with like UFO landings, or that they're healing properties found in the vortexes of ley lines. Yep. And all that. So everybody that discusses ley lines agrees that there is something not ordinary, something, right. You know, extraordinary and crazy about ley lines, but nobody really knows why. And Matt and I have in many episodes discussed ley lines in the sense of, you know, they are basically power lines. And, you know, there's a reason that our ancient ancestors built things upon these ley lines, is because there's an energy source that makes up these lines, or that travels, you know, like the globe's magnetic pathways, mm-hmm. basically, you know, because yeah. if you're discharging electricity, it's got to go some way. And that's kind of what they think about these ley lines, is that this is where the power transfers from one point of the globe to another.
Yeah. You know, so the ley lines and how they relate to the Great Lakes. If you were on our See You Live show back in January, Adam and I discussed.
Seems like so long ago.
I know. It seems like forever ago. It's like 6 months ago. No. We
it's
discussed.
Not 15 years ago.
Yeah. But we talked about how this unique layout and relationship of well-known ancient sites around the world seem to fall on this line that you can essentially make that encompasses the entire Earth. Well,
yeah.
It's not just that one line that we discussed, and we bring up the ley lines, such as, you know, there's a ley line that connects the Great Pyramid with Stonehenge. You know, mm-hmm. we're talking about these lines. They connect ancient monuments all over the globe, not just in the circle, but they also connect ancient geographical phenomena like the Great Lakes. So,
right.
if you look at how, you know, the alignment of the Great Lakes and these places, you can essentially work from the center point of where the Great Lakes, where Michigan and Superior and Huron and Ontario come together it almost looks like they fan out like a flower from a center point. If you take mm-hmm. that point, you can work outward with 10 radii, and they go straight out to well-known ancient sites. Easter Island, Machu Picchu, mm-hmm. White Sands, Mumbai, all of these places, and actually create, you know, a pentagon inside which, of course, you can draw a star and make a pentagram. And
right.
there's, I mean, you know, you really got to have some free time to come up with yeah. these kind of relationships. But when they do and you look at them, you're like, huh, that's curious.
Right.
You know,
right.
I wonder if that just happened by chance. Maybe. But, you know, these relationships to these ancient sites, it just doesn't seem like it happened by chance. Somewhere along the line, I believe, and I think Adam agrees with me, that ancient civilizations understood that the earth held some type of energy in either in relation to the stars or you know, the relation to these ley lines. And that's why some of these places exist where they do.
Right, right.
And because of the way these ley lines pass out from the Great Lakes area, there's a lot of things that happen. And Lake Michigan is absolutely no exception. And so when we start talking about the triangle, you know, we begin to see some things that, you know, really, really get bizarre. And then, of course, you know, you take an individual incident like we're fixing to talk about, and it's like, oh, well, you know, yeah, that's weird. You know, it's strange. And then you move on. Well, then you're going to take a lot of these incidents, and then you're going to take this information that we're presenting about ley lines and these relationships to other ancient sites around the world, and you kind of sit back and you go, huh.
Yeah.
This can't be a coincidence. Something's got to be going on that we just can't wrap our head around just yet.
Right. So we're not here to discuss just Lake Michigan. We said that the topic of this episode was the Michigan Triangle. So we need to get into talking about the Michigan Triangle. Now, the Michigan Triangle is a part of the Great Lakes in North America, obviously, and the area resembles an acute angle triangle. So,
oh, it's adorable.
It's very cute. So, to be precise,
that was terrible.
It was terrible.
You can cut that out if you want.
I'm going to leave it in, but I'm just going to keep plugging along like it didn't happen. Now, along the left side of Michigan's quote-unquote mitten, the first side of the triangle is formed by connecting Ludington to Benton Harbor, Michigan. Now, the second side spans from Benton Harbor to Manitowoc, Wisconsin, and then the triangle is completed by its third side that links Manitowoc back to Ludington. So the bizarre occurrences in the area of the lake have been, you know, the cause of A, this episode, and B, a lot of research that's been done over the centuries. And, you know, we're not talking about a ginormous area of the lake, being that it is so big, but it's large enough. So researchers have argued a lot about what is the first event that actually occurred. So let's look at one event, one account that claims it to be the very first. The history of abnormal incidents in the Michigan Triangle can be traced to the late 17th century. Now, this article says it was a time when the world was exploring new ways and routes of expanding trade. So Le Griffon, one of the largest sailing vessels of its time, set out on its maiden voyage in 1679 to find a northwest passage to China and Japan. All went well until the ship reached the Michigan Triangle, never to come back. So, although it's not the only ship that might have been submerged, they say the horrifying part is that no wreckage of the ship nor any traces of the crew have been found to date.
It's not unusual that they didn't find it then. I mean, we've already talked about how deep this lake is. But we haven't found any evidence of it now, or when we had the technology to go much deeper and look around for it. So that's what's really strange, is that we've got some of these ships that just seemingly vanished.
Yeah, and it's nuts to think about, because you're in a lake, and yeah, it's a big lake, but you're in a lake. So you would think that some of these ship parts or bodies or something would come to the shore at some point and be found.
Right.
But there's a lot of them. There's a lot of them that have not.
Right. All right, Adam, let's take a minute and talk about this week's sponsor, EveryPlate. With EveryPlate, you can experience full plates and fuller wallets with America's best value meal kit. Get meals you'll enjoy and your bank account will love delivered right to your door. Think of it this way. One meal is the same price as one cup of coffee.
I know, it's great how affordable they really are. EveryPlate offers contactless delivery to your doorstep for easy home cooking on a budget, so you don't have to talk to anybody and you've got your box of food. There's less time deciding what to cook, and that means there's more time spent enjoying the good food with your family. Now, EveryPlate does the meal planning, the shopping, and the prepping for you, taking the time-consuming guesswork out of cooking. And like we've said before, Matt and I hate going to the store. We hate planning the meals and all that stuff. We don't mind the cooking, so EveryPlate is great. They send everything to your house, and it's very affordable, and you can just open the box and start cooking, which is great for Michael, too, because Michael has a short attention span, and he can help us cook with these EveryPlates. We did a sticky sweet chili chicken the other night.
Oh, that sounds good.
Oh, it was fantastic. And even Michael liked it. And he's not too big on the spicy stuff because this wasn't really spicy. It was like that kind of the mild chili. So you just get the flavor of it. And it's got this like sticky sauce over the, oh, it was amazing. And he enjoyed cooking it. It was easy. Everything was right there. It was fantastic.
And Adam, you know, these meal kits have become so common that everybody wonders which is the best one. And what sets EveryPlate apart is its affordability.
Absolutely.
It is the most affordable meal kit out there. So give it a shot. Adam and I think that you'll really, really enjoy this, spending some time with your family, both preparing your meal and enjoying it.
Exactly. And to make it even better, our listeners can get 3 weeks of EveryPlate meals for only $2.99 per meal. That's cheap. Where else can you get a meal for $2.99 that's not fast food drive-thru?
You can't even feed yourself for $2.99.
Exactly. So you can get $2.99 per meal, and all you have to do is go to everyplate.com and enter our promo code GRAVEYARD3. That's GRAVEYARD and the number 3.
That's right. You get 3 weeks of EveryPlate meals for only $2.99 per meal by going to everyplate.com and entering the code GRAVEYARD3. That's GRAVEYARD and the number 3. And like Adam said, there's some disagreement about what the first actual occurrence was. I mean, it's a widely held belief that the actual first occurrence in the Lake Michigan Triangle was not recorded until 1891. Now, the Thomas Hume was a schooner that was built in Manitowoc, Wisconsin in 1870. The ship was christened the H.C. Albrecht, in honor of its first owner, Captain Harry Albrecht. Now, in 1867, the ship was sold to a Captain Welch from Chicago. In the following year, the ship was bought by Charles Hackley, a lumber baron who owned the Hackley-Hume Lumber Mill on Muskegon Lake. The ship was then renamed as the Thomas Hume in 1883 after Hackley's business partner. Now, the Hume would make many successful trips across Lake Michigan until May 21st, 1891, when it disappeared, along with its crew of seven sailors. Now, not even a trace of the boat was ever found. The Hume was on a return trip from Chicago to Muskegon, having just dropped off a load of lumber. Now, the mystery of the disappearance of the Thomas Hume led to a number of speculations as to what happened. Some, for instance, suggested that the crew of the ship stole it, turned it into another vessel by repainting it, or that it was struck and sunk by a much larger freighter, and the captain swore his crew to secrecy. Now, others suggested that the ship was a victim of the Michigan Triangle. Now, you know, I got to think, if you're a captain and you run down another ship and wreck it and it sinks, and you've got to try to convince everybody on your ship to keep their trap shut.
Yeah.
That's got to be hard.
It's not going to be that easy.
I mean, at some point, this captain's going to die, and somebody may be hanging around and go, hey, you know what? He told us all to be quiet, but we ran over that ship. That never happened. So, I don't believe that. Seems like a pretty hard task to have taken it and repainted it and made it a whole nother ship. Okay? But right. we may have actually
and
found
like
it.
Like you said, with a lot of other conspiracy theory type things, how are you going to keep that many people silent for that long?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But the Hume wouldn't be seen again until 115 years later in 2006 when the A&T recovery diving team found it in the southern part of the lake in remarkably good condition. Now, researchers still examine the wreckage in an attempt to piece together what happened in its final moments. Now, there was a lot of question as to was this actually the wreck of the Thomas Hume? And after a few years, they finally determined that they believe that it indeed is. So 115 years, this thing sat at the bottom of the lake and nobody found it. Until this diving team found it. It's pretty amazing.
That is. That's crazy how long it can stay submerged.
Yeah. So they don't know what happened. So by searching the wreckage, they're hoping they can piece together what exactly happened. And as strange as that might be, I'll do you one better. In 1883, the crew of a wooden tugboat named the Mary McLean that worked out of the Chicago Harbor had a really weird experience. They claimed to have witnessed huge blocks of ice falling from the sky while they were on the lake. For an entire 30 minutes, ice rained down so powerfully that it caused dents in the tug's wooden surface. Now, we're not talking about hail here, folks. We're talking about huge hunks. 2-pound hunks of ice, they say. And the crew actually managed to save a large chunk of the ice in its galley icebox when they would retell this story. Now, what makes it even more strange is it apparently happened on with a cloudless sky.
Weird.
Yeah.
So it's just random ice falling from nowhere.
Yeah. Random ice, no clouds. It's not hail. What is going on? You know, there's these enormous hunks of ice falling from the sky. It's like somebody just blew up a glacier.
Yeah, you'd think the end of the world was coming.
Yeah. Like,
and just clear sky and you got 2-pound chunks of hail falling on you.
Well, hell yeah. In 1883, that's probably exactly what they were thinking.
Yep, exactly.
Now, another ship that mysteriously disappeared was the Rosabelle. The Rosabelle was a wooden two-masted schooner built in 1863 at the Leonard H. Boole Shipyard in Milwaukee and cost an estimated $4,500. Now, it's a lot of money back then.
Yeah.
On October 30th, 1921, the Rosabelle left High Island bound for Benton Harbor with a load of lumber. The ship apparently met a storm east of Milwaukee in Lake Michigan. She was found 42 miles east of Milwaukee, bottom side up, with no survivors and no bodies.
Wow.
The yawl was missing, leading some to believe that she was involved in a collision, but the Coast Guard later determined that that was incorrect, as there were no pieces from another vessel found. She was later beached in order to salvage her lumber, but some sources say that there were 11 sailors on board that were lost. Others say 9, but there were no survivors and no real reason for this ship to have completely capsized.
That's wild.
Yeah, it's really
that
wild.
Is wild.
And you know, we talked about the winds and the waves and the odd current in Lake Michigan. It does have some really peculiar weather patterns that occur over the lake. And so it's not just like going out for a leisurely cruise to get from one end of this lake to the other. I mean, it can be very, very treacherous. And when we're talking about ships that sailed over this lake, you know, from the late 1800s, early 1900s, you know, they weren't necessarily equipped to handle those kind of storms.
Sure.
I mean, these weren't ocean liners. I mean, these weren't ships that were meant to travel in weather of that scale.
Yeah, but you got people building what they consider lake vessels, mm-hmm. because on the shore of the lake, they're not seeing this crazy weather that happens in the middle of the lake. You
Absolutely.
Know, so they're not 100% prepared for this. Like you said, they're not building ocean worthy craft.
Yeah.
So I can see how they get themselves in trouble.
Exactly. Now, the weird things and disappearances that happened on the lake and in the Michigan Triangle aren't limited to ships. The Northwest Orient Airlines flight 2501 disappeared in the Michigan Triangle in 1950. Now, the plane was carrying 55 passengers and 3 crew. And it was one of the deadliest commercial airliner accidents at the time. The pilot had just requested to descend to 2,500 feet because of a, quote, severe electrical storm, which was lashing the lake with high velocity winds, and then the plane disappeared from radar. Now, the cause of the crash was never determined, as the plane's wreckage was never found. Now, although human body fragments and light debris were found floating on the lake surface, they couldn't actually find the bulk of the wreckage.
Human body fragments.
Human body fragments.
That's a statement you don't hear
That's
often.
That's right. It's one you don't particularly want to hear.
Yeah, know? Right. Or say, for that matter.
That's exactly right. But about 2 hours after the last communication with Flight 2501, two police officers reported seeing a strange red light hovering over Lake Michigan and disappearing after 10 minutes, leading many to believe that a UFO was to blame for the plane's disappearance.
You know, if they pick up people and examine their souls out of their body,
that's right.
Why not do this?
Yeah, I mean, that may explain why there was so little evidence found of the plane. I don't know.
Right.
That it's really, really strange. But it's also strange that when the police officers witnessed this, it was roughly the same time as the plane would be making their distress call.
Right. And we hear stuff like that about the Bermuda Triangle too.
Exactly.
That there, you know, weird lights and weather patterns and, you know, ships disappear, planes disappear. You don't find anything. If you do, it's just a little something that just enough to let you know that, yep, something happened, but not enough to tell you what happened. And I mean, as Matt keeps going, listen to these parallels between the Michigan Triangle and the Bermuda Triangle. It's incredible, the parallels.
Right, especially with the plane going off the radar. I mean, that's a common theme with these disappearances in the Bermuda Triangle. We got the plane on radar. We've got them on radar. But where'd they go?
Yep,
just exactly. All of a sudden out of the blue.
And that doesn't normally happen in a plane crash. You know that the plane is crashing because you still have them on radar.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and you know their final destination because of radar.
Yeah, yeah. Now, one of the more famous cases from the Triangle is the disappearance of Captain George Donner. On April 28, 1937, after picking up a load of coal in Erie, Pennsylvania, Donner's freighter, the McFarland, was traveling through the dangerous ice-filled lakes. Now, the captain had been resting in his cabin after guiding his vessel through a particularly treacherous course and left instructions to awaken him when the ship neared its destination. Now, about 3 hours later, a crew member went to alert him that they were nearing the port. When the second mate arrived at the captain's cabin, there was no trace of him in his room or anywhere else on the ship. The door had been locked from the inside, and the mate had to break in. A thorough search.
Yep.
Yeah.
I've been through one of those before. A search is even more thorough than a search.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
It involves body cavities and things like that.
It's one step more thorough.
Man, I hope to never get searched.
Oh, dude, never get searched. You don't recover from a good searching, I tell you. There's always something that sticks with you after a good searching.
Man, you know, I got searched and I didn't even get dinner. Oh, but this thorough search of the rest of the ship didn't reveal any clues as to where the captain may have gone. Yeah, it's a ship, for crying out loud. Where the hell is he going to go? Overboard?
Right, exactly.
So reportedly, the McFarland was in the Triangle at the time the captain is said to have disappeared. And to this day, no one's been able to figure out what happened to Captain Donner. So here is the story. A guy just goes missing off a ship. And it's not just any guy, the captain.
Yeah.
Captain, his stateroom is locked from the inside, and he's nowhere to be found. Left to rest, gave specific instructions on when to come wake him up, and he's gone. And he's nowhere on the ship. You got to think, everybody on the ship is going to know the captain. So it's not like he's going to be able to sneak around. I mean, if he runs into anybody, they're going to be going, well, we saw him, you know, over here. Or he was here just a few minutes ago. Or about
he's hiding
an hour.
Behind that barrel of beans, and he said, "Shh, don't tell the first mate."
That's right. So where are you going to hide? And then they're going to search for you. So now you got to try and stay hidden on a ship. I mean, no. I mean, he obviously wasn't there. So either the captain decided, "Hey, I got all these people through this really dangerous ice, and I'm done. I'm cashing in, and I'm going to jump
overboard."
No more
captaining.
Which doesn't make any sense.
No.
Or something really weird did happen to him.
Mm-hmm.
So, now, as we mentioned before with Flight 2501, that wasn't the only UFO sighting that's occurred around the Michigan Triangle. And in fact, it has become well known as a hotbed for UFO activity. But one of the most famous stories comes from March 8, 1994, when calls flooded 911 call centers to report strange sightings in the night sky. Now, the reports came from all different types of people, from police, a meteorologist, you know, local residents, Michigan's beach resorts. Hundreds of people witnessed what many insisted had to be UFOs. Now, Cindy Pravda of Grand Haven remembers that night in pretty good detail. She says there were four lights in the sky that looked like full moons, over the line of trees behind her horse pasture.
Hmm.
Pravda remembers, I watched them for a half hour. Where I'm facing them, the one on the far left moved off. It moved to the highway and then came back in the same position. Pravda told the Free Press, the one to the right was gone in the blink of an eye, and then eventually everything disappeared quickly.
That's now, weird.
Yeah. Now, Daryl and Holly Graves and their son Joey told reporters in 1994 that they witnessed the lights in the sky over Holland, Michigan at about 9:30 p.m. on March 8th. They said they saw six lights out the window above the barn across the street. Now, Joey Graves told the Free Press in 94, I got up and went to the sofa and looked up at the sky. They were red and white and moving. Now, other people gave similar accounts, including Holland police officer Jeff Veldhaus and a meteorologist from the National Weather Service office in Muskegon County. Now, what's really weird is that the meteorologist recorded unknown echoes on his radar at the same time Veldhaus reported the lights. Now, the meteorologist says, my guy looked at the radar and observed three echoes as the officer was describing the movement. Now, Leo Grenier of the National Weather Service office in Muskegon said in 1994, the movement of the objects was rather erratic. The echoes were there about 15 minutes, drifting slowly south-southwest, kind of headed toward the Chicago side of the south end of Lake Michigan. In 1995, the Free Press published the conversation between the National Weather Service and Veldhaus. What do you think it is? Said the Weather Service radar operator. Veldhaus described witnesses seeing five to six objects, some cylindrical with blue, red, white, and green lights. The radar operator said there were three and sometimes four blips, and they weren't planes. Planes show as pinpoints on the scope. These were the size of half a thumbnail. They were from 5 to 12,000 feet at times, moving all over the place.
So they were big.
Yeah, they were big. Three were moving toward Chicago. I never saw anything like it before, not even when I'm doing severe weather. So, you know, this is one of those weird UFO cases that it's kind of like the Phoenix Lights. You've got so many witnesses and so much evidence, you know, that says,
right.
Okay, we're not saying it's a UFO. We're not saying it's aliens. We're not saying it's anything. All we're saying is there was something in the sky that night and a lot of people saw it. And we have evidence that it was there because we have radar evidence that it was present. You know,
right.
Just if you want to discount all these people that walked outside and said, we saw a bunch of lights up in the sky, and you can go, oh, well, it was this or oh, it was that. Well, what about the fact that the National Weather Service picked it up on radar and can't explain it and said it was not a plane because planes aren't that big on the radar. And these things were huge.
Right. Yeah. If you're talking a plane is a pinpoint. Mm-hmm. And these were thumbnail size.
Yeah.
That is ginormous.
Yeah.
That's ginormous.
So, I mean, you can see why people from such a wide span were able to see these things and to see these lights. But it's one of those stories that just doesn't get a lot of play when you first start looking into unexplained lights in the sky. It was a story that I hadn't heard before until I came across it researching this. So, but a pretty amazing story. But again, it's something right there in the Michigan Triangle.
Right.
So you see what I mentioned at the beginning of the show when we were talking about coincidences and things like this and ley lines, that you take them by themselves and they just seem like weird occurrences.
Sure. But
when you put them all together and then you start going, they're all happening within this triangle. And then you take all the data about the ley lines, you know, and about how Lake Michigan was formed and how old it is and how deep it is and the weird weather patterns, you really start to wonder, is there something going on right here that's causing a lot of these strange occurrences? And even if it's not causing it, it's definitely a magnet for them. You know, there's something there that's drawing some oddities to that area, and people have taken notice.
So the thing that, like, it makes me think of is we think of, like, Skinwalker Ranch, and is there something at Skinwalker Ranch that's causing the phenomena, or is Skinwalker Ranch just an attractant, like a magnet, to this weird phenomena? So is the Michigan Triangle a lot like Skinwalker Ranch in that sense, that it's just attracting, or is it causing? And I don't know that we'll ever really know the answer to that, you know, in our lifetimes, but there seems to be a lot of places that are that way. And it's just, the Michigan Triangle is one of those weird things that not a lot of people know about, because it doesn't get a lot of attention. And so Matt and I thought it would be cool to bring some attention to it.
But, you know, my idea, and I'll touch on this again, but my idea is that with all of these situations, ancient civilizations understood that something was going on, and they tried to either harness that power or to understand it. And we in the modern era see the remnants of what mm-hmm. what they had done in an attempt to either understand it, or we're seeing the evidence of their understanding, which I tend to lean more towards the latter, that they had managed to figure it out. And for whatever reason, that knowledge was lost, and we don't have it today. And we're trying to rebuild it by looking at these ancient ruins and these clues that they left behind that tell us they knew something. They had to have. You know, they were able to do things without the technology that we have. We don't understand what technology they had. And it makes us believe, much like Adam has mentioned many times, they had technology that we are unaware of. That they had somehow managed to harness some power. They had some type of communication with a higher intelligence that allowed them to do things that took us centuries to be able to do. Because we see this evidence. Yep. And this story right here, you know, this kind of shows it. In 2007, Northwestern Michigan College professor Mark Holly discovered a North American Stonehenge while diving. The stones were found 40 feet below the surface of Lake Michigan. Some are arranged in a circle, and one appears, according to Holly, to have a carving of a mastodon, an animal that went extinct about 10,000 years ago. But in order to confirm the age of the stone and the legitimacy of the carving, experts want to see it firsthand. And Holly says, experts in petroglyphs generally don't dive, so we're running into a little bit of a stumbling block. But if it's found to be true, the formation would coincide with the post-ice age presence of both humans and mastodons in the upper Midwest. The formation, if authenticated, wouldn't be completely out of place. So if we look at the history, that's why it was so important to understand the history of how this lake was formed. At one point, this area was not underwater. And there were
it was 100 feet lower than it is today.
Right. And so there were humans and these mastodons and other animals living on land in the same area. And this could be evidence of that, that they were there. And now it's just been covered up by water.
It shows the building of an important thing like Stonehenge or you know, any other great monument on a ley line or right. near a ley line.
Right.
Because you've got two of them that bisect Lake Michigan. And here we find a Stonehenge type thing. And the evidence, the factual evidence bears it out that during that time, the lake was 100 feet lower. Absolutely. During that time frame that they're calling for 10,000, 11,000 years ago, that's when the lake was 100 feet lower. So it absolutely shows that this is 100% plausible that this could have happened.
Yeah.
And why would anybody go through the trouble of building a giant monument? I don't think it's because, oh, hey, it's pretty. Let me move these big ass rocks over here and do something with it. There was a point. They did these things for a reason. And most of the time, the reason is either going to be a religious ceremony or a magical something because they believe they can harness the power of this area just like Stonehenge.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, much like the original Stonehenge and other stone arrangements around the globe, the question is why? And, you know, that's what Adam's talking about. It wasn't for fun or because it was pretty. So, what would the significance of an ancient stone circle, despite the fact that it wound up at the bottom of the lake, what would it be? I mean, maybe there is some mysterious energy that the indigenous people knew about or even harnessed. Now, some have claimed the triangle is a time portal and that it could bend time, causing a metaphysical force with a supernatural vortex of energy. An energy that would later cause shipwrecks, plane disappearances, bizarre weather patterns, and sea captains to seemingly vanish into thin air. So, I mean, what about this? I mean, we know about the ley lines. You know, we understand that the original Stonehenge is built on ley lines. We know that the original Stonehenge connects to a ley line with the Great Pyramid. Here is another similar structure, much like the Stonehenge, that we find centuries later because it's now underwater in an area where all of these strange things happen. And ley lines cross right there. So, I mean, much like the original builders of Stonehenge, did the indigenous people of that area of northern Illinois and Wisconsin and Michigan, did they know something enough to say, we need to build this structure to harness this energy or to connect ourselves with the stars? Because this is the spot. This is the spot on the earth where this is supposed to happen.
Right.
We don't know, and we may never know. But as Adam said, the evidence points to the fact that they knew something. They knew something that we don't.
Right. And it's amazing to me that we've said it before, and you alluded to it just a little bit ago, the knowledge that we've lost that, you know, obviously has been erased because of, you know, I mean, if you look at just the burning of the Library of Alexandria, how much knowledge we lost there because they burned the books. You know, there was supposed to be thousands of years of knowledge, and some of this could have been encapsulated in those books. But we have all these quote-unquote mysteries and these mystery areas in today's modern world, like the Bermuda Triangle, the Michigan Triangle, Skinwalker Ranch, all this stuff. What if these aren't truly mysteries? We just find them mysterious because we don't understand them.
Right.
And if we had a better understanding of what the ancients knew and why they were building these structures, we either could advance ourselves further or, hey, here's a little trick that we can do over here. If you walk over to Lake Michigan, you can jump back 5 minutes in time. You know, I mean, What are we not seeing? There's got to be something that we're not seeing. This isn't just, to me, a quote-unquote mystery area. There's something mysterious only because we don't understand it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, we have dribbled on for a long time to get to this point, but I mean, I think it's a pretty amazing point that we're seeing every day things that are unearthed that give us a little bit more insight into the fact that ancient civilizations understood this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That they had an idea of what our connection in the universe really is, and the power of the planet that we live on, and the power that maybe the stars hold, you know, over this planet.
Right.
And it may take us centuries more to get to that point. But I mean, we could theorize the rest of the night as to how they got this. And, you know, there's a lot of people that say, you know, look, there were aliens, you know, that lived here. There was an ancient civilization of superhumans, of a highly intelligent race that either disappeared or, you know, went extinct or went into hiding or something. I mean, we talked about them with Mount Shasta.
Mm-hmm. And lizard people
you know, lizard people and everything. So
it's come up several episodes.
All of these things that we talk about that are so strange, so many of them come back to these type situations that ancient civilizations understood more about the planet and the stars than really we do. You know, mm-hmm. there is a chance that they had knowledge that we don't have. Even with the technology and with the brilliant minds that work on this every day today, they're working a jigsaw puzzle with pieces missing.
Absolutely.
And you know, we as humans try to make a piece that fits there, and it doesn't always fit. And it just seems like if we just had these two or three more pieces, we can understand what they understood and why they did what they did.
Right.
And, you know, that maybe we understand that they didn't know what the hell they were doing, and this was just all a big coincidence. I don't believe that for a minute.
Yeah. Me either.
I don't believe that you build pyramids and you stack stones that somehow seem to line up out of coincidence. It just, I don't buy it. I don't care what you say. It may be completely innocuous as to why, but it wasn't by coincidence. I just can't buy that.
I know. I think everybody knows I can't buy it either. So it doesn't seem like, we're attributing too much to this stone circle, you know, under Lake Michigan, when it was just some caveman building a
rock garden.
Makeup. Yeah. Or like a makeup area ready room for his wife.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't something like that. It there's a larger significance that we're not seeing. Yeah. And, you know, like Matt said, we've gone on and on. So that brings us to that time of the episode where we ask you guys, what do you guys think? You know, we've told you about Lake Michigan. We've told you about the Michigan Triangle. And we've talked about the ley lines and the weirdness that happens around there. What is your opinion on this stuff? Do you believe that there is a weird vortex area in Lake Michigan that causes these problems? Do you believe in, you know, the power of ley lines and what people say? Let us know. You know, email, get on the website and let us know, or find us on social media and let us know.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just go and search Graveyard Tales. It's the easiest way to find us. And while you're at it, you can check out our website. It's graveyardpodcast.com. And on our website, you can find, you can listen to the show. You can find links to buy Graveyard Tales merchandise. and you can become a patron. And thank you so much to the people that have donated to the show. Like I said, we've added the video of Adam and I doing this right here, like you wanted to see us flub up and mess up and all this stuff. It's there for our $10 patron members, and there's going to be more of that coming. So thank you once again to everybody who has donated to the show, and thank you everybody for listening. So guys, remember, we're going to be dark the next 2 weeks, but in graveyard fashion, we are going to give you a bonus episode, so you don't have to hang out for 2 weeks to wait for some new content.
Exactly. So be prepared for that. It won't be a normal Graveyard Tales long episode. It'll be a short one that we're pulling from our Patreon archive, so it'll give you the opportunity, if you're not a patron, to see what we do over there, and maybe you can sign up for Patreon and listen while you're waiting for us to come back.
So until next time, we'll save you a seat in the graveyard.
See you soon.
Listen to this. I'm on the website to read this story. And all of a sudden, a Best Buy ad starts playing in my ear.
Well, if it comes,
and now I'm hearing, I can't.
If it comes through the audio, we'll have to edit it out, or we're going to get sued. So,
you can't hear it though.
No, I can't hear it.
It's just in my ear. But anyway, so here we go. In 95, the Free Press. God. I'm getting tongue-tied in this one. La, 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 la.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there. Yeah.